Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
In her first novel, The Lovers and the Leavers, Abir Hawk undertakes a literary challenge that I suspect even the most seasoned writer would find daunting. How do you tell the stories of those people, old and young, cosmopolitan and rural, living throughout the world in the South Asian diaspora? She meets this challenge through a series of interconnected stories, in which the links among characters emerge subtly but inextricably, a web of family ties that reaches from Bangladesh and India around the globe. Moreover, she captures these stories not only in prose, but also in poetry and photography, making The Lovers and the Leavers a multimedia, multi-genre experience. It's an ambitious undertaking, spirited and subtle. Yet for all of Hawk's impressive artistry, she seeks very recognizable ends. To give us a vivid sense of place, as rich as the people who inhabit it, and to render the inner lives of those people, to let us feel their passions and their pains, those that mark them and make them, sometimes beautiful, sometimes broken, but always compelling. Abir Hawk, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
It is great to have you here, and I can't wait to talk about your interconnected novel full of these wonderful stories. It's called The Lovers and the Leavers. But before we get to that, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your background as an artist. You have this nomadic sensibility that comes alive in the work.
I have my parents to thank for my nomadic sensibility. I was born in Nigeria. My parents moved there before I was born. And then we moved to the States when I was in high school. And used to visit Bangladesh a lot when I was a kid, but I never lived there properly until I was an adult. And so when I went back to Bangladesh to actually live there as an adult, it was the first time I was actually spending a lot of time in that space. And it was kind of like alien landing, but it was a really amazing experience as well. And this book of stories is all set mostly in Bangladesh and India, where I spent about 2 years writing, taking the photographs, and trying to put it all together.
And we should let the readers know right out of the gate that this is indeed a book of short stories that link together. And I'm sure we'll get to talk about that. But it's also a book of poetry, and it's also a book of photographs.
Yeah, I started off writing as a poet. And so that was my first love, basically. And so, and I started photography a lot later. So by the time I got around to writing this book, it was, I had this sort of idea to combine, to have a book that you could read in different ways. So you could see the photographs and imagine the mood or the characters in the story, or you could read the poems and get a different sense. Sometimes the poems are written by a side character or another character who becomes a main character, or they're an inner dialogue. And so there would be multiple layers for the book, for reading the book. And my original idea was something kind of a little bit wilder, where I'd have different colored pages and you could read the red pages for one version of the story and blue pages for another version. But this one, it became a little bit more narrative, organized than that. But I'm still really happy that I was able to put those three things together, prose, poetry, and photography, and find a publisher who is willing to publish it. It was kind of a difficult thing to try to find somebody in these states who wanted to publish it, but HarperCollins India, the editor there, loved the book and gave me all kinds of beautiful artistic license in the way it was laid out, and I think they did a really beautiful job.
One of the wonderful experiences of the book is that you do have these moments where you hit, say, the photograph, and the mood as an experience of the work, I don't even want to say reader, because at that moment I just kind of gaze. The photographs are very meditative and evocative. And I was just curious, as an artist, when you're putting together these different media, how do you think about the kind of collective experience that they amount to? You know, what is the artistic principle that guides you forward as you do that, especially if you can't do color-coded pages?
It's an interesting thing, and I think it has so much potential, and I wanted to have different dimensions. One of the things that's great about photography is that you don't need words. It's like a translation of an experience in a way that doesn't require language, which I think is really important to me anyway, because there's so many things you can't say. And so that was, but you know, there's lots of different ways to use all these different genres and media. And the way I decided to do it in this way is just one of them. Just one way to show our world, which can be read in all these different chaotic and multi-layered ways.
And it's probably worth letting listeners know that you not only work, say, in three genres in one book, but that you are also a memoirist and a travel writer and an essayist who's working on a second novel and another collection of stories, which I think, if I read right, is a collection of erotica. And then there's also going to be a collection of ekphrastic poems.
I'm trying to do a lot of different things. Part of it is I just want to learn how to do different things well. When I started this book, it was about, I think, like 6-7 years into my writing, my life as a writer. And I had never written fiction before. I had only been writing my memoir and poetry. So it was an experiment for me. And when I first started writing the stories, a lot of my friends, my lovely readers who had read my memoir stories, were a little bit maybe not sure of my direction, because they had loved my stories from growing up in Nigeria. And my fiction was definitely not working as well when I first started, but I was kind of determined to get better at it. And so I just kept writing more stories and revising the ones that I had and getting lots of feedback and just getting more of a feel for how to tell a story in a short story format that was sometimes loosely based on my own life or the lives of people around me. But maybe just, something different. Different from what I had been doing before.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you hear about writers that have this kind of range, the hope is that when you enter into one particular work, there'll be this capaciousness. And I think this work has it. And one of the ways that it registers that range that I think you bring as an artist is through voice. So there are the voices that are in the poems, but the number of characters that interweave throughout this. Could you maybe introduce us to the world of the novel? That might be the best way to say it. But the number of voices you hear and the range of characters and the range of ages and experiences and places in the world, it's just impressive.
Yeah, I can. One of my goals was to try to get as many different kinds of characters' voices in there as possible. So I wanted older and younger. I wanted different genders. And different classes as well. So one of the characters that comes up in a couple of the stories is this maid who grew up in the village in Bangladesh and comes to the city to work. And her love life is the subject of two different stories. And she appears as a side character in a couple of the other stories. And then her employers and her employer's kids also, who are in a different class, of course, they end up also figuring in different stories. The stories are all linked, so there's always some place where somebody is mentioned and they'll come back in another story. So there's probably about, I think there's 9 main characters in 12 stories, but a lot of repetition throughout. There's... most of the stories are set in South Asia because I wrote this book while I was on a Fulbright scholarship to India and Bangladesh. So I wanted the book to be centered there and also to have characters who, so even the characters who are in America and there's one story that's set in Spain, are of South Asian descent. So they're Indian or Bangladeshi. And so I have some, drawing from my own experience, there's a couple of stories that are set in America that follow the Bangladeshi American immigrant experience. And there's one story in Spain because I used to live there for a few, for half a year. And I fell in love with Barcelona and I wanted to have a story set there. So those are kinds of the ranges. I wanted teenage characters. I wanted, middle-aged characters and older. I think it's probably skewed towards more younger characters because that's more of what I know how to write about. But I definitely want to branch out, especially in the book that I'm writing now. I'm trying to write from an older man's perspective, and that's been a big challenge for me.
Well, there are definitely a lot of young and hip characters in it. The chapter in Barcelona is quite amazing because you're in this world of Bangladesh and it's so alive. And then here we are in the States, which is something, a reader in America is going to know a little bit better perhaps. But then here we are in Barcelona seeing the city through the eyes of this young teenage boy who's going through kind of adolescence and older brother worship and soccer. And so the range of empathy is varied, and I think what you end up getting is a kind of entire population scattered throughout several continents.
Yeah, that was the South Asian diaspora is it's everywhere. So it's kind of fun to write about. And I've seen it growing up in Nigeria. There was a big community of South Asians there, and of course in the States. And when I was in Barcelona, that was there too. I met people who had grown up there, people who had immigrated there later on. And yeah, it's a fascinating topic to me because I'm part of that diaspora, and it's an interesting story. Everybody has a different story.
So the form,
depending on where.
Yeah. So how do you tell that story, right? Because you don't have the kind of traditional Aristotelian unities of place, time, character. You're going all over, and it seemed to me that the way that you interlink the stories so that everyone is both a primary and a kind of secondary character in other people's lives becomes a very nice way to capture that global phenomenon.
Yeah, I think it's nice. The things that I had challenges with, sometimes I had really clear ideas about the characters I was writing about, but it was often sometimes the place that would give me, that I would write about. Like when I was writing about that's the story about the teenage boy in Barcelona, and he's also one of his passions is windsurfing. And I had a friend who was a windsurfer who read the story and she said, you don't have enough wind in your story. and this is something I was totally just, making up because I've never actually windsurfed. And she's like, you have to have a real sense of the air when you're there. And so that was something I had to go back and look at the story and see if I could rewrite it so that it would be clear that this boy was really in his element and paying attention to it. Or there's another story that's set in the village, which I've spent a lot of time in my father's village in Bangladesh. And I'm following this little boy who is growing up in the village, and he's got sort of a little bit of a special power. And he lives with his family, his mother and his father and his brother. And someone, a friend who read the story, said, it's too quiet. You know, the village is not quiet. Everyone's all up in your business. And so I also, that was another thing that I went back and I had to go think about how, what it would sound like in the village, what people would be around. And he was right. It is always true. When I was in the village, there's always like a child looking in through the window or someone coming in through the door or something happening outside. So I think it's, for me, one of my greatest joys is writing about place. And I would like to write about it in a way that has integrity or feels right to people who have been there.
And we should probably let listeners know that when you say you wrote from the perspective of a young boy, this boy is six.
Yeah.
How do you enter into the mind of a six-year-old boy who's very worried about a goat?
Yeah, this boy and a goat. And maybe I'll read a little section from this story. But it's funny, when my editor first read that story, he thought that perhaps the language was too elevated for a six-year-old. And I went through it again. And I don't, you know, I think he agreed with me after I talked through it with him. But none of the thoughts in there were thoughts that were too complicated for a six-year-old. They were maybe worded in a way that he wouldn't say, of course. Then again, maybe nobody would talk the way that I would make them talk in the story. But I think it was right to his feelings and to his sensibility, the way that I had written the story. At least that's the way I felt. And I had a couple of other readers read it just to give me their feedback. But I think it's one of my favorite stories because it's a little bit different from some of the other stories. It's not so much of a love story as it is. Well, it is between him and his pet goat, a different kind of love story. And it was also an ode to my father's village, because it's that's what I was thinking of when I was writing the story, is this beautiful rural pastoral landscape.
Well, I think it would be great to hear a little bit of the novel. Thank you.
Okay, so this story is called Alo, which is the name of the little boy. It means light. And it starts off, each of the stories starts off with a poem. So I'll just read the first, the poem in a few pages. She sits on the bed as the rain counts out the minutes of her life on the tin roof, the hip, the hop. She ignores the call, her husband in hunger, her sons in thirst, she in thrall to what's coming, the hip, the hop. A teasing wind steps through the grilled window, furls the pages of the calendars on the wall, obsolete all. 2005 falls back with a slap. 1998 caresses 99. Dhip, dha. She undoes the kopa at the back of her head, and a lightning crackle, crow-black hair loose to the air. And now the real rains begin. Dhip, dha. My name is Alo. I am six, and it is the rainy season. Nobody knows, but I can guess what people are going to say, so I don't have to listen most of the time. Sometimes, when I have something else I want to do, I will jump into the future and answer from there. That way, I can finish talking sooner and go play in the rice paddy field with my goat, Kishmish. There's lots of water in the fields, and the stalks are sharp and green. I like the sound it makes when I walk in it, the swirl of the water around my ankles, the mud sticking, sucking between my toes. Abba is telling me about Qurbani Eid, about and how he's going to sacrifice his son for God, but God stops him before he does it. He puts a ram under Ibrahim's falling knife instead. That's why we celebrate Qurbani Eid by sacrificing an animal, Abba says, because of Ibrahim's faith. I hate it. I hate it because Abba is going to slaughter my goat, even though he knows I'm afraid of blood. He says I shouldn't be, that it will be an honor for Kishmish, but I don't want him to die. I want to stop thinking about blood, so I look ahead to see what Abba is going to say. He's going to talk about how blood makes all the same. A picture of Abba's body merging into mine comes into my mind. It's not scary, but I don't understand it. We're not the same, I shout as I run out of the house. I don't wait to hear what Abba says. I never wait. It's Abba who told me that looking backwards is only for old people. Sometimes when I jump into the future, I see the wrong answer. But that doesn't happen very often, and no one seems to notice anyway. Amma knows when I'm doing it. When I look ahead with her, she always stops what she's doing and watches me. When I get it right, she claps her hands and laughs, her thin bangles clinking. She leans down and kisses me on the forehead and whispers, "Now run out and play, my little prophet." Joy is my older brother. He is 7 and just started class 1. Ammu sewed his uniform at night after dinner. Abba could have done it because he's a weaver, but he won't because that's Ammu's work. It took her a month because she's not very good at sewing. Abba says she's not very good at many things, only at talking and wasting time. She only laughs when he says this. Her hair is coiled into a shiny kupa at the back of her head. She likes to shake the bun loose and retie it. Abba always falls silent when she does this. I wonder if he can hear the same thing, the spark and hiss of the strands swishing against each other. Ammu says she'll make my uniform too, to be good, or else I won't get to go to a good school like Joy. I don't want to go to school, not if Joy will be there. He always has reasons to beat me. When he hits me on my head, it hurts so much I can't even cry. I just sit on the cool dirt of the compound and try to push the buzzing out of my body in short bursts. Push, I think. Go. I don't think I'm making any sound, but Ammu runs in and asks me what's wrong. I can't push and talk, so I don't say anything. Just let Allah be, Abba says from the doorway, retying his blue check lungi around his waist. You make him weak with all your fussing. He turns away and bumps into Joy. What are you doing here, he asks. Kisuna, Joy says. Nothing. Then go to bed. But I have homework, Joy says. He loves saying he has homework. Abba always leaves him alone then. Ammu can't read, but still she sits with Joy every night, looking over his shoulder by the hurricane lamplight. She says if he studies hard, he can become like her great-grandfather, who used to be the school headmaster. Joy doesn't want to be headmaster. He wants to be a police inspector. Then he can beat up anybody, even in front of Abba and Ammu. I think
that's a great place. I think in this passage, one of the things you see that runs throughout the novel is this sense of lyric beauty that'll crop up, like the moment where the braid or the bun becomes undone and there's the spark as the strands of hair swish against one another. And there's a kind of lyric intensity that plays against plot and character for a beautiful harmony.
I think in this story specifically, because he's little, I figured that he would be more, like the things he would talk about or think about would be very sensory. And so I really tried to focus on all the senses that surround him. And also because he has a little bit of a way of looking forward into the future or with people, he's got a bit of an ESP going on. And so I wanted him to have kind of a keen sense of place.
So when you build a world from Alu's perspective, that's very different from, say, Kumla's perspective. Could you tell us a little bit about her so we get a sense of the range of people populating the book? I know you mentioned her in passing earlier, but she's a fascinating character.
Yeah, she's based on somebody I actually knew who was a maid in my aunt's house where I was living when I was there. These two stories, she unfortunately tragically died a couple of years ago, unexpectedly from an illness. But her stories are the ones that inspired the stories in the book. Kamala is a maid, and she's never been to school. She's worked as a maid her whole entire life. And she's found love late in life. She's in her 50s and she's met this man, and she is in love with him. And he's, you know, their relationship is a little troubled, and that's the subject of the stories. She was actually initially, when she was in the village, she did get married, but her baby died. And so she ran away, basically, from the village, from her relationship and from the death of her child, and ended up in the city. And so that's kind of the world she lives in now.
And so she also has a love story. And I think, you know, the title is The Lovers and the Leavers. And that's one way to get a range on kind of what occurs. But it seems to me that if I were going to describe the book to someone and I wanted to encourage them to read it, I would say it's in a large sense, a book of love stories. And some of them are charged with desire, and other ones are kind of infused with tenderness. And some of them are about longings, and then some are just about loss. But I was wondering if you saw that thematic driving it forward, or, you know, you had mentioned a lot about place.
Yeah, when I first started writing the stories, I didn't have a sense of a theme. I thought I was going to go to Bangladesh and I was going to write all these exotic stories because they would be in a different place, a different people. And while it's true that the stories have a setting that's very different from, say, stories set in America, I soon found that people the world over think about similar things. They are thinking about love and loss and their families and money and ambition and all the same things that people... And actually, a conversation that I had with the maid, the actual maid in real life, is sort of exemplary of my experience of writing these stories. She had, she was, you know, in love with this man who was in another city, and she came to my room one day very upset, and she asked a question that I've asked myself, and many people have asked themselves, which is, why doesn't he call? And I remember thinking, this woman who was so different from me, who grew up in the village, who's older, who never been to school, is also thinking about love in the same ways that I have often thought about love. And so it was kind of a revelation in a way to me, which, you know, maybe it's also obvious, but it's nice to experience it for yourself, to see how people are the same wherever they are in the world.
Yeah, I think you can recognize the universal, but the artist needs to capture it in the particular, and that's where you really see it, as opposed to bracing cliches. Well, I want to make sure, because I want readers to have a sense of the kind of range. Tell us about a character like Rox, or maybe, you know, a story like The Alphabet Game, because that's a different note that the book hits that I'm sure will... draw a few readers in.
So one of the main characters in the book is this Bangladeshi American immigrant called Roxanne, and she is the subject of a couple of different stories. And she is there's the story The Straight Path is about her kind of crush on this teenage boy in their Bangladeshi community, and about her friendship with her best friend, and also another friend in the community, another boy, Raza, who's he's a side sort of a side character in Straight Path, but then his teenage years or adolescent years become the focus of another story called The Alphabet Game. Where he's growing up in this house with his sister, who is kind of a bit of a bad girl, and he has run-ins with her friends, who are also kind of a little bit bullies, and but he ends up having a little thing with one of them. But I wanted to show a couple of different stories or voices from the Bangladeshi immigrant experience. Raza also is half Bangladeshi, half American. So that also contributes to his differentness. Immigrants in general, right, they end up having sometimes a bit of a bubble experience where they just stay within their communities in the country that they're living in. But Raza is kind of forced out of that because his parents are divorced and his parents are of different nationalities and ethnicities.
Well, what I've been wanting to share is sort of with listeners is the range of the book and kind of the interesting aesthetic choices that you've made that have resulted in this beautiful interweaving of forms and characters and place. Would you be able to read us a little bit more of it so that they can have a direct experience?
Sure. I could read, maybe I'll read a little section from The Straight Path, which is set in America and has Rox as the protagonist. So this story is called The Straight Path, and it starts off with a poem. Oh, my soft skin, sharp tongued girl, how does your garden grow? With violet diversions and careless replies and clairvoyance planted so. Oh, you're crooked in straight disguise. What would I do for a kiss? Reckless, racing, I make my escape. Your flowers spilling from my lips. 8%, says her voice hoarse, scornful, confident. She laughs and crosses her legs. Her buxom body curves like a wink. They're joking, right? Well, says Rox, it says in the article that women tend to understate their sexual exploits and men overstate. She looks up from the Baltimore Gazette at her old friend. She finds it hard to look away sometimes. Ela has always been striking. When she was younger, the punk haircuts and goth makeup only highlighted her large eyes. Now, she's returned from Bangladesh, all grown up and more beautiful than ever. She's also walking the straight path, after years of stylish hedonism. This includes a Bangladeshi husband with exceptional educational and social pedigree. And although she's currently wearing Western dress, Ela has a closet full of saris she can tie with as much grace as the next auntie. Yeah, that makes sense. But what's the percentage for married women cheating now? Ela is clearly engaged. Rox is amused, wondering if Ela's enthusiasm speaks of something real. She continues reading. 13% of married women in America cheat on their spouse, up from 8% a decade ago. But the men's percentage hasn't changed in years. It's 22%. That's a big fat lie too, Ela says. Guys must be well over 50. Ela pulls back her henna-streaked hair from her face and lets it go. Here, let me read the article. When they were seniors in high school, just before Ela left for Bangladesh, she came on to Rox. They were drunk and had just stumbled out a bar in the Inner Harbor south of downtown, where a man, believably named Bam, had bought them drinks all night in return for half smiles and mumbled thanks. Rox stood by Ela's mother's Mercedes, parked thoughtlessly in the shadow of the grimly peeling wharves, while Ela fumbled for her keys. Let me drive, Rox had said. She was perhaps half a rum and coke less drunk than Ela was. Are you kidding? This is my mom's fancy car. I have to take the blame if something happens. She usually never lets me drive it. It's just that the station wagon is for the mechanics, and also, she's away. Ela was wearing a tiny leather skirt and a gauzy top, her bare legs golden in the light of the lone street lamp. Rox had on an equally ambitious skirt in green cotton. They drove off at 10 miles an hour into the suburbs, smoke from Ela's cigarette trailing behind them, Chardet mourning from the speakers. The moon was so bright that their headlights seemed unnecessary, and after their 10th laughing fit, Ela stopped the car by some gnarled pine trees and leaned across the butter-colored seats towards Rox. Rox flops across her narrow twin bed and looks around. Her old lamp-lit bedroom is at once familiar and strange, as if all that's left of the person who lived here is her aura, outlined by the books heaped everywhere, from the Velveteen Rabbit, inscribed with her mother's slanted script on her 5th birthday, to the Delta of Venus, her college boyfriend, her parting gift, and everything in between. Feroz bursts into the room and she jumps up in equal glee. He's her favorite of all the kids in her parents' circle of friends. Last time they met, almost a year ago, he was jubilant at having finally grown taller than her and insisted on a photograph for evidence. Now he's 17 and unmistakably taller, though his narrow frame has yet to fill in. He has been stronger for years, though, as she found out during an arm wrestling match a couple of years ago. Feroz is athletic and reckless, so he's hardly ever without an injury or two. Their first bonding moment was when he was 9 and had an especially bad scrape on his knee. Rox, home on fall break, was the only one to a viewing and then offered to throw ball with him. She wonders what Feroz will be like. Silly and subversive and sharp. Perfect first love material. I'll stop there.
Great. Well, I think what you also get in that passage that runs throughout the book is the sense of the passage of time, the kind of layering in history that these characters share with one another. And that happens between stories as well as within the stories themselves. And it gives you a sense of richness and depth to the world that you're bringing to them.
Yeah, I'm glad that comes off.
Well, I'm curious, you've created this portrait of sort of the South Asian global diaspora. And now that the book's out, how have readers found it? Have you had any responses that you found particularly rewarding or surprising?
I have had wonderful responses from readers, which has been really, really, very rewarding. And I also, I really loved the response to the fact that the book has photographs and poems in it, and people appreciate that because you don't see so much of that in books. I mean, it's expensive to print photographs. It's annoying to lay out poems inside of prose, and so it's a challenge for publishers. And again, I'm really glad that HarperCollins India was happy to do all that for me. But yeah, it's been really great listening to people respond to the stories and different people. Like, there's a review in India who just responded to the book, and it was lovely to hear what resonated with her. She actually enjoyed, she thought the voice was strongest when it was the story set in the States, which is great. And then I think the people who are in the States have really liked some of the stories that are set in the village in Bangladesh, for instance. So I think it's a little bit of, where seeing stories from other places, I think that gets to people.
I think for me as a reader squarely in Midwestern America, it felt like travel, I was swept up in the travel writing that had also the benefit of story and character. And it made for a very rich experience.
Yeah, travel writing is one of my favorite kinds of things to do. So I think it's probably going to be a factor in every in an aspect of every kind of writing I ever do.
Well, so where are you going next? This novel is out, and I very much hope we'll continue to receive attention. But what artistic projects are in your near future?
I've been working on I'm going to have my memoir, which is a book about growing up in Nigeria, the States, and Bangladesh. That's going to be published next year. So I'm excited about that. That's actually the first book I wrote as part of my thesis at my MFA program at University of San Francisco. And it's been rewritten many times since the 10 years since that I finished the first draft. But in its final incarnation, it's going to be finally put into published form, which I'm super excited about. But both this book, The Lovers and the Leavers, and All of which is my memoir that's coming out next year, are books that I started and finished drafts of several years ago. So I've actually been working on a number of different things since then. I've been working on a novel for about 4 or 5 years, which is about memory loss. And about how a man who loses his memory at two very different times of his life, first as a young person who's a drug addict, and then later on in the book, he's an older man with dementia. So I wanted to see how these two very different places in his life would affect it. And I started, it's set mostly in the Bay Area, and it's got a big chunk that's set in New York. And I started writing it when I was in Bangladesh, which is, it was kind of funny that I started this book that's very, very strongly set in the Bay Area, because the Bay Area figures so largely in my heart. It's one of my favorite places in the world. So the book is also a bit of an ode to the Bay Area, and also just an ode to memory and what it means in our lives and our personalities. So that's been a project that's been ongoing. I still haven't done a final draft to my satisfaction, or to anyone else's anyway. And I've also been working on a a collection of short stories that are erotic travel-themed short stories. I'm only about halfway through those. And those, again, are also about place. So place is as much of a character as the love stories that are in them. And picking weird and cool places. I've written one set in Bolivia, one set in Beirut. There's one set in Bangladesh, and one in Galway, Ireland. And I've also been working on a series of poems because I wanted to get back to writing poetry more. I'd sort of spent maybe 10 years writing prose and stopped writing poetry, and it was a big gap in my life. And so I thought maybe I would use photographs from my collection and take a different photograph each time and write a poem that would be a sort of an inspired by the photograph, maybe a story about it or the mood of it. So it's a series of these poems. I call them photo poems, but acrostic poems, I guess, is the technical term for it, which still to me sounds like a fake word, but I know it's a real one. Those are two new or three new projects that I've been working on the last couple of years.
That sounds like a full plate. Well, I hope that you'll come back and talk to us about the memoir when it comes out.
Yeah, I would love that.
Well, before we let you go, could you tell us a little bit about The Olive Witch? That's the name under which people can find you online, and on your website they can see some of your beautiful photographs. But we only have the title, and I'm curious about what's behind it and what it means.
Yeah, it's actually a bit of an odd thing. It's just a Olive Witch is the name of my memoir, and it's also the name of my website, olivewitch.com. But it came about completely as just a play on words. It's actually it's a nickname I had in college with my college boyfriend. Used to be in love with Rage Against the Machine, this band, and they had a song which it said, one of the lines in the song was, "All of which are American dreams." All of which are American dreams. And he twisted the words and he would call me all of which and say he was my American dream. And so it just kind of stuck, and he would just call me all of which, and other people did also every now and then. And I thought it was a funny and a completely random name, but it's sort of become part of how I think about the book now, just because my memoir anyway, and my website, it's become a moniker of sorts. Even though it stems from something that's just basically a nonsense punning of the words.
What would life be if we couldn't embrace nonsense?
Right. Exactly.
Abir, thank you so much for being on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really lovely to talk to you.
This is Eric LeMay for the New Books Network, and you've been listening to an interview with Abir Hawk, author of The Lovers and the Leavers.